In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to History Hacks, dedicated Second World War air power podcast, Hedge Hopping with me, Matt Bone. The C-47 is the iconic workhorse of the Second World War. In our fifth Hedge Hopping sortie, we welcomed Adam Berry and Flight Lieutenant Seb Davey of the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight to the show, and we discussed the training of the 9th Troop Transport Carrier crews and the experience of that night of nights when it is said that everything went wrong. In that episode, we pulled the night of the 5th and 6th of June apart and saw the incredible work of those crews and their C-47s. Now, with COVID restrictions easing, the opportunity to take hedge hopping on the road arose. So Boney Sr. and I were very kindly welcomed up to Coventry, where D-Day Veteran is currently under restoration. Night Fright is an incredible C-47. She was just about everywhere in the Second World War. She flew every major operation, and currently she is under restoration with a team led by Charlie Walker of Walker Logistics, and they kindly invited us up for a nose around, a brew, and a chat about this remarkable aircraft that we may all remember from Guy Martin's D-Day Landing TV show, and soon will be gracing our skies. So the important thing to remember is this is an active restoration, so there is lots of riveting noises going on in the background. If you have headphones on, be aware that every once in a while, there's two chaps busily working away to get this aircraft ready. So, we hope you enjoy the visit up at Coventry with Charlie, and I'll be back after our chat. Charlie, thank you for having us down. We are standing next to your lovely aircraft. Why don't you give us a bit of a description, as audio is not really good for us telling people what we're going
to
see.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's good to have you here. Good to show you around and tell you a little bit about what we're up to. Yeah, essentially, it looks like a big jigsaw puzzle at the moment, doesn't it? But this is our C-47 Night Fright, a C-47 that we've been working on restoring since 2012. So, yeah, a really significant aircraft, an aircraft that was based at Membury, which is a place close to our heart, and an aircraft that took part in every major airborne mission throughout the Second World War. So, a really, really significant C-47.
Superb. So we're going to have a little wander around inside of it. And just so everyone knows, they are working hard as we speak. So there will be lovely riveting noise going on in the background. So shall we go in, Charlie?
Yeah, come on. Let's go and have a look.
You've done this before.
Definitely not the first time. But yeah, come on, have a look. I'll give you a bit of a guided tour if you like.
Fantastic. Take us away.
So yeah, so we're in the cabin, the fuselage of the aircraft. So yeah, this is where the action would have taken place. So you can see there would have been a row of paratrooper seats down each side of the fuselage here. So yeah, that's where the paratroopers would have sat with all of their gear. This is the static line. So this is where the guys would have hooked up. So, you know, I'm sure you've seen, you know, Band of Brothers and all the other representations. So the stand up, hook up, you know, move forward. And this is obviously the cargo door where the paratroopers would have exited. So yeah, this certainly would have seen a lot of action. Night Fright took part in, you know, D-Day, Operation Dragoon, Market Garden, Varsity, you know, all of the famous missions. So yeah, this is a part of the aircraft that would have seen, you know, could tell a few stories, that's for sure.
And she's very big as well, because I'm, you know, 6 foot, so are you just about, and we're able to stand quite happily, so a paratrooper with all his gear wouldn't have had too much trouble.
No trouble, probably more trouble actually getting into the aircraft itself, to be honest. I think one of the things that still strikes me, and, you know, I've done this a number of times, is just how steep the angle is in the rear of the aircraft when you walk from the back to the front. But it's a big old thing. It's nearly 95 feet from wingtip to wingtip. So it is a pretty large aircraft. And curiously, it wasn't designed for combat, was it? It was designed to carry passengers as an airliner and was then pressed and adapted into service. But obviously a role that it carried out really, really well.
And you, now that you mention it, so it comes in just how steep an incline that is. Because, of course, we're tail-dragging aircraft, not like an airliner that people would be used to today. So we've got a good gradient to lumber up for someone as unfit as me is bad. But when you've got 100 pounds worth of gear, £100 worth of gear, that's certainly going to make it a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see pictures, don't you, of the crew chief physically pushing the paratroopers up into the aircraft, and you can see why they would need to do that. I mean, I think that's probably one of the two things that strikes most people is just one, how steep the angle is, and just two, how big it is, really.
In your head, when you think Second World War aircraft, you're thinking quite compact, you're thinking small due to power and weight, but this is positively roomy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, ironically, the cockpit's probably the smallest part of the aircraft, which is where hopefully I'm going to spend a significant amount of my time. It is a big old thing, but let's move further
let's
up
head up.
And have a look at some of this. I mean, so before we move into the radio operators and navigators and the cockpit, I mean, the idea is that this is going to be a time warp, really. So once you step in the back of the aircraft, it's like to the 6th of June 1944, so you really do get a truly authentic feel of what those guys would have experienced on D-Day. So we're going to leave no stone unturned, so whatever would have been fitted to the aircraft in period, you know, will be found, sourced and refitted. So that's the idea.
That's fantastic. Right, so we're at the forward bulkhead. Let's head in.
I mean, obviously, it looks a little bare now compared to what it will look like, but, you know, in the day, you would have a radio operator sat here, you would have had a navigator with a stool, all of the various sort of radio and navigation equipment. You know, there's radio racks that are missing from here. We haven't got to installing all of those yet, but we're going to have everything from, you know, the wooden table, the wooden stool, all of the original radio and nav gear, which we found and is sitting in a room next door in the hangar, which is going to be really exciting. I think that's probably part of the project that's going to be the most exciting is, you know, when the structural work's completed and we get to install that detail and just recreate that experience, really. So it's going to be the same with the cockpit. You know, the idea with the cockpit is it's 6th of June 1944, so the instrument panel's exactly the same, the instrumentation will be the same, you know, to the extent you can't see it because it's boarded over, but there's a big rectangular instrument in the middle of the panel, which would have been a basic auto. So we found one of those aircraft, we've chopped the face off of it, and we're going to recess all of the modern transponders and radio equipment behind it and then plug the face back over the top. You know, you're not getting any of that modern feel.
That's absolutely brilliant. Just to say, we were saying how roomy it was back there. We stepped forward into the crew compartment, and it's as the sort of nature, the nose starts pinching in, it gets a lot more cramped up here. So how many people would be up here?
Generally, obviously, you would have the two pilots, so the captain, the co-pilot, and then you would have had the radio operator, the navigator, and a crew chief as well. They wouldn't necessarily have carried a navigator on all of the missions, but, you know, Night Fright did carry a navigator for the majority of what she did throughout the war. And so, you know, if we fast forward to what we're going to be doing, we will obviously have two pilots up front, and then what we call a crew chief sort of slash loadmaster, really, taking care of the paratroopers in the back. But you're right, it is a cramped cockpit, and, you know, from a flying perspective, it's not the easiest to see out of. It's like any tail tragger, which is why you weave when you're taxiing, so you can actually see what's in front of you. But when you're sat here, you really have to almost stand up on your tiptoes and see where you're going, really.
It does. I remember when we had Seb Davey on, he said it is looks like looking through a letterbox. And he's not wrong, because it just sort of tapers straight away to that lovely little windscreen that you have up there.
Yeah, exactly. Forward visibility is not the best, but obviously that immediately changes on the takeoff roll, you know, when you get the tail flying and you get a bit more of a perspective. And then, you know, once you get it into the air, it's a different story, really. Yes, it's a big, heavy old aircraft, you know, with none of the sort of the modern gizmos that you find these days. But once it's in the air, it's just an aeroplane. Is it a bit of a handful in the critical phases of flight? Yeah, it is. It's a tail dragger. And, you know, if you're not careful, particularly on the landing and takeoff rolls, it will catch you out. But it's great fun.
Oh, I'm really jealous, because this looks a lot of fun. A, just to get back together, but B, when she's ready to fly. But a lot of effort, because it's been 7 years now?
Yeah, blimey. If we go back a little bit, we first bought the aircraft in America in a scrapyard in November 2012, I think it was. And yeah, we've come an awful long way since then. You know, I guess initially we set out, you know, if I go right back to the beginning, we were going to get Night Fright and have her as a gate guardian at Membury, put it on a pole. It wasn't actually going to fly. And then we thought, well, yeah, that's great, but be even better if it could fly. And then from
that was a pub conversation, wasn't it?
Something like that, yeah, something like that. So we've come a long way since then. And, you know, from a flying perspective, initially we were just going to make her look right, for want of a better word. And, you know, we're going to paint her in the right markings. No way were we going to go to the level of detail that we have now. But one thing led to another. And, yeah, fast forward 8 or 9 years and here we are.
It's those sort of decisions which most people think would be madness, but brings us here to this beautiful, beautiful aircraft. Let's head outside and have a wander around and look at the wings.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it.
So we're now standing next to a wing, Charlie, which looks, to my untrained eye, just about ready to go.
Yeah, it's certainly getting there. I mean, funny thing is, the wings are something that we ignore for 90% of the project so far, really. We just sort of push them into the corner of the hangar, for want of a better word, and think, you know, we'll deal with that later, so to speak. And I think we didn't think that they'd be a huge amount of work. They were a bit of an unknown, and we always had a bit of a quandary as to how do you properly inspect, you know, what's gone on inside the wings, carry out any repairs that are necessary, and then how do you protect what's in there going forward, really, from any further corrosion. So we hummed and hard, and eventually we made the difficult decision to completely de-skin the underside of the wings, which is a massive, massive undertaking. It's probably not far off a month's work just to de-skin the wings. You know, that's just so you can see what's going on internally. And I'm really glad we did, to be honest. There was quite a number of repairs that needed carrying out, you know, anything from replacing stringers, you know, spar booms, aileron hinges, upper and lower attach angles, you know, bits of skin itself. So you name it, really. So it's a project we started probably at the end of November last year, and we're less than a month away from completing that now. So I mean, as you said, they look absolutely fantastic. They look like new, probably better than new, in fact. So it's going to be a big milestone once we get those finished. We're probably going to go straight through to top coat paint finish on these, which will be the first part of the aircraft with top coat paint on, which is really exciting. And you know, you think the aircraft looks big now, once you've got these on, it'll transform the thing, and it'll take up a lot more of the hangar. So yeah, very exciting.
And I guess that gives you guys added confidence, knowing you've stripped it right down, you know, they're A100% ready to go.
Yeah, absolutely. You can never be too careful. And as I say, I'm really, really glad that we've done what we've done. It's been a major, major undertaking, both financially and time-wise. It was 100% the right call, and I'm really, really glad we did it.
Well, they look absolutely fantastic, which, you know, it's just sort of annoying all the listeners, really, because they don't get to see it. You're saying about a month to go, once you're ready, how long to fit and rig once they go on the fuselage?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, actually, I was just chatting to Ben, the project lead, this morning as to, you know, whether we want to attach these wings as soon as we finish them or not. And I think probably the consensus at the moment is we won't attach them straight away. And it sounds silly, really, but it transforms the size of the aircraft, the space it takes up, and how easy it is and isn't to work on other parts of the aircraft. So I think initially they will just be put back on the shelf, so to speak, while we finish off a few other areas, and then look to attach them. But certainly we'll go as far as making sure all of the controls and the rigging is in place, so when it does come to attaching them, it's just a case of bolting them on, so to speak.
It'll be that IKEA thing. As soon as you put them on, you're going to go, we shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's literally just a ring of bolts. I mean, I know the listeners won't be able to see that, but it is a ring of bolts to attach them. So it's that simple, really. So as long as all those holes line up, we should be all right.
It's the moment of dread as well as truth.
It's that old adage. So they came off, so they'll go back on.
You're going to regret saying that now.
Probably.
That's definitely staying in the edit. So when we were talking before about how difficult it is actually to see inside of it, once these go on again, that's basically them done for the foreseeable future. It's difficult enough looking in, even with the small inspection panels that we can see on the top.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the idea. This will never be need to be done again. You know, there are inspection panels, and you can, you know, for want of a better word, get a snapshot of what's going on inside there. But with what we've done, this aircraft will outlive us. That's for sure.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the sort of geeky questions that will come up. Fuel tanks going in, they're going to be fully self-sealable D-Day spec, will they? Or are you going to go slightly simpler with them?
No, they're just going to be as was, to be honest. I mean, those are, whether those are the original fuel tanks to the aircraft during wartime, I'm not 100% sure, really. But those are the tanks that the aircraft came with when we bought her. So those are what are going to go back in with a few repairs. There's a little bit of welding and patchwork that's had to take place on those. But no, they've been done. They've been leak checked and they're ready to go back in. So yeah, that's something that we're pretty close to achieving.
The detail on it is stunning. There's something lovely about a freshly riveted section of aircraft, and your team have done an absolutely stunning job on this.
Yeah, we're really lucky, to be honest. I mean, I don't think there definitely isn't too many places in the world where you could have a job like this done. And, you know, as you say, it's a testament to Ben and the team at Heritage Air Services here that they've done such a wonderful job, and you know, no doubt we'll continue to do so. And, you know, we're really, really excited, you know, the day she's going to finally roll out.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And you can hear them hard at work in the background.
Yeah, absolutely. They're beavering away, so that's riveting you can hear taking place in the background. So that's been a fairly continuous noise in the hangar over the last 4 months or so. So I think the team are probably fairly sick of the sound of the rivet gun. So I'm sure they're looking forward to the wings being finished as much as I am.
So, Charlie, I think one of the amazing things about Night Fright was she was everywhere, wasn't she? Yeah, you know, D-Day looms large, but that was just one evening for her in a long lifetime worth of work.
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good way of putting it, to be honest. Yeah, absolutely. She's she took part in every major airborne mission throughout the war, and then obviously had another life again post-war. So yeah, built in Long Beach in 1943, and she went on to become part of the 436 troop carrier group. So the 436 arrived in Bottisford in the Midlands initially. It was at that point that Night Fright was assigned to the 436 troop carrier, and specifically the 79th troop carrier squadron, which meant that she was going to be based at Membry. And you know, the part of the whole reason for the project for us is Membry. That's where we're based as a family. That's where our family business is. So that's kind of where the whole thing started, really, with us looking into the history, what aircraft and squadrons flew from Membry, what roles did they carry out, and why was it so significant. And that's what led us to C-47s, Troop Carrier Command, and then eventually Night Fright, which we found in a scrapyard in Arkansas in late 2012. So yeah, as you say, D-Day, obviously the most synonymous airborne mission with World War II, but Night Fright carried paratroopers and towed gliders as part of D-Day. She was part of a detachment of C-47 that were posted to Volturne in Italy to take part in Operation Dragoon, the invasion of southern France. She took part in Market Garden, in Varsity, did a double glider tow as part of that. So yeah, every major airborne mission you can think of, as well as, you know, all of the CASIVACs and resupply missions that I guess are not you know, quite so well publicized. But yeah, a huge amount of history, huge amount.
Because it was never just doing the drops or doing the tows. It was constant work in between, because we tend to think of the big stuff, don't we? But it's, like I said, the CASVAC, the resupply, all of that just constantly between the major operations.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a fact that's probably overlooked, to be honest, is, you know, you tend to think of these aircraft carrying out the major famous missions and then just parking up and, you know, sort of waiting for the next one. Absolutely not. As you say, it was constant sort of shuttle run. That's evacuating casualties, you know, carrying in fuel or other supplies. It was just a non-stop sort of relentless resupply mission, really.
We've been chatting for about 10 minutes and the boys haven't been recording. Now we're recording, they're back at it. Love them. What about post-war? Because she's had a long life before that scrapyard in Arkansas, and saw quite a bit more interesting things. So who did she fly with in between your collection and the end of the war?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Another sort of her second life, really. So yeah, she flew for a number of different airlines, be that carrying passengers or hauling cargo, including livestock. So, you know, if I just pick on a few. So she flew for an airline called Piedmont Airlines, where she had various modifications. So an air stair door replaced the cargo door at the back, and obviously it would have had all the soundproofing and plush seats and interior, etc., etc. So that's one good example. She actually went back to Europe and joined the French Navy, where she trained naval navigators. So as part of that, we can see that the Astrodome was moved on the aircraft and various other modifications. She then went back to the States and flew for various different cargo operators, hauling car parts and live poultry, all sorts. And she ended up with over 60,000 hours on the airframe, was listed on eBay, failed to sell in an eBay auction. We picked her up in a scrapyard shortly after that in late 2012.
You really can get anything on eBay, can't you?
You really can, and we really do, trust me.
Oh, you got to love eBay. Okay, so we've come underneath her now, so we're just standing underneath the cockpit, between the engines. What power plants have you got on it?
Yeah, we've actually had three engines completely overhauled in zero time, all three of them in the States with two different companies. So these are Pratt & Whitney 1830s, twin watts. So yeah, I mean, the irony is we haven't even run these engines yet. So we've had these probably hanging on the aircraft 18 months, something like that. And as you can see, there's various red flags dotted around, which means that, you know, those are areas still requiring attention, you know, essentially unserviceable. But to be honest, there's not a huge amount left to do to the engines. I mean, if we needed to make those engines run pretty quickly, we could. It's all of the subsystems that, you know, need to feed into those. So, you know, the hydraulic system is pretty much complete, same with the oil system, and in fact the fuel system is not far away either. I mean, you can actually see all of the fuel tanks sat under the aircraft, mm-hmm. ready for installation. So, you know, we're not that far off. We've got brand new propellers, which are behind you in a big box on that rack up there, so they need to be assembled and fitted. The reason we haven't done that is they're what we call calendar life. So essentially, as soon as you assemble them, a clock starts ticking until you need to inspect them next. So they're better off in the box than they are sat on the aircraft at the moment. So yeah, that's where we are with the engines. There's not a huge amount left to do. It's, as I say, all of the subsystems, really. But I mean, I'm probably going to regret this saying this, but the idea at the moment is to have engines running by the end of this year. That's the plan. That's something that we're aiming for.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, exactly. But I've sort of given up on deadlines and schedules now. I've set enough of them, and we haven't done well with deadlines. So yeah, I'll probably regret that. But yeah, that's where we are with the engines at the moment. Yeah, as I say, the irony is we haven't even run them yet. But yeah, and then you can see a lot of the other detail as well. As I said, we've pretty much overhauled every part, so you can see that they're working on a wing tip here. It needs a little bit of a repair to the tip there. You can see these are all of the electrics, which is something we haven't really started yet, if I'm honest. There's a lot of work to do on the electrics. If we move around the other side a little bit, you can see some of the detail in the hydraulic piping running up the side of the fuselage. Yep. On this side. These are the battery bays here, which have been completely redone. We can have a little look under one of the nacelles. So you can see the landing gear, again, completely overhauled. I mean, just look at the detail in the nacelles. Those are the oil tanks up there, which have been completely overhauled as well. One thing I didn't mention on the engines which we're working on at the moment is a fire detection system, which is something we're just finalising at the moment. What else have we got to do? We've got the brakes to completely overhaul and fit. Fuel tanks there, you can see, four of them have got to be installed. I mean, if we can dive under there a little bit, so you can have a look under here. So, you know, the centre section is ready to accept the fuel tanks. These tanks have all been repaired, leak checked, and essentially are ready to go. We were just waiting on a couple of little parts we needed to install them, just some bits of rubber to protect the centre section when the tanks are installed. So they're ready to go, but we've been concentrating on the wings for the last 4 months, so we kind of down tools on the rest of it, really. So there's a lot of stuff that's ready to be fitted and installed. It's just waiting for us to get to it. So yeah, there's plenty that's been done, but there's plenty more to do.
So things like the tanks, they're not time limited as well. It's just major moving parts, really. Yeah, that's going to have the inspection.
Yeah, exactly. That's all for things like engines and propellers and stuff like that, really. But yeah, I mean, to all intents and purposes, it's a nut and bolt restoration. Though we've literally, you know, when it arrived here, we took it apart piece by piece. The center section was separated from the fuselage. The tail was removed. The wings were obviously removed. It had no engines, no landing. So it's been a massive jigsaw puzzle.
I guess one question would be the fixtures for the power packs that went underneath. Will you have things like that on it as well?
That's a very good question. A very good question. The answer is yes, we'd like to. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm aware, there's no other C-47 in the world flying with power rack. We'd have to look at the legalities of doing that and how we would fix those to the aircraft. There are a very limited number of power racks available in the world. We have found some. Whether we can acquire them is another question, but it's very much something we'd like to do. I can't say at the moment that we're definitely going to do it, but we're certainly thinking about it.
Because it does seem like they're being a little bit more lenient with hanging things off of aircraft now, because the new Greek Spitfire has a couple of 250 pounders on it now.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely something we'd have to look at. I mean, if I was to stand here now and make an educated guess, I see there's no reason why we can't install the power racks themselves. Whether we can have the para packs in the racks, I'm not sure.
So but that quickly.
Yeah, it's worth looking at, that's for sure. But if it can be done, you know, then that adds to the originality and authenticity that we're looking for.
The big question really is for listeners and people that want to get involved in even a small way, can people help? Can people get involved other than, you know, just watching your videos and the updates on Facebook?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we welcome everyone to come and get involved. And at the moment, we're a little bit challenged. That, as you can see, what we need at the moment is core engineering skills, really, from a restoration perspective. But one of the things we are doing is building a museum at Membury, which will pay tribute to Troop Carrier Command and what happened at Membury. And, you know, at that point, we're very much looking to establish a team of volunteers and a ground crew to come and get involved with not just Night Fright, but, you know, as part of the museum as well. So absolutely there's going to be a chance to get involved.
So one of the privileges of doing this gig for me has been able to come into shops like this and see these incredible skills that are happening, because these are works of art, but using skills that many would have thought have passed us by.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, sort of real, sort of old-fashioned engineering skills. And, you know, we're so lucky to have such a wonderful team here carrying out the work for us. And, you know, I think that's something that we're really proud of. I mean, you know, if you don't do projects like this, then, you know, these skills get lost and they don't get passed on to future generations. And, you know, I guess speaking generally, that's something that people ask me quite a lot is, you know, you must be mad. Why are you doing this? And I suppose the honest answer is I probably am. But, you know, at the same time, if you don't preserve bits of history and those kind of skills, then, you know, it just gets lost.
Charlie, this has been absolutely great fun. This is just stunning, and we cannot wait to see her fly. So thank you so much for inviting us down, myself and Boney Senior, who's standing on the other side of the wing. But thank you so much, Charlie. This has been great.
Absolute pleasure. You're more than welcome. And you'll have to come back and see us when we're a little further down the line.
Maybe on that magical wing day.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I'd just like to thank Charlie Walker and the Night Fright team once again for letting us come up and have a look at their incredible restoration project. If you want to learn more about the aircraft, her history, and of course, most importantly, her future, you can head to their website, which is night-fright.com, where you can learn all about the project and also get in contact if you have some of those fantastic engineering skills. If not, you can buy some merch as well and wear the fantastic logo on your chest with pride. We're taking Hedgehopping on the Road a few more times over the course of the summer, so please listen out for those shows. Of course, if you've got a restoration project that you'd like to chat to us about, please do get in touch. Hit us up via the Twitter machines or through the Facebook page as well. We have lots more exciting episodes coming up on History Hack soon from some incredible guests, and you're going to be blown away by some of the topics that they're going to be chatting about. But remember, all of this needs your support, and you have been incredible over the last year. But as things change and the world opens up once again, we need your support more than ever. So remember to check out all our guests' latest publications on our very own bookshop. You can find that at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, where there's some great titles just waiting for you to pick them up. Of course, a percentage of every sale goes to supporting the podcast, which is wonderful, and we thank you so much for that. There's also Patreon, which means it's now time for the Patreon bit. In 2020, when the boss ladies, Alex and Alina, started History Hack, the world was very strange, and unfortunately, it looks like 2021 is going to be equally strange. We would love it if you're able to support the podcast in any way. It will allow us to keep up the regularity of the pods, and also the great guests that we've been able to bring you over the last year. We exist on Patreon as History Hack, and also on Podbean, our podcast host's own platform called Patreon. The reward tiers are being updated at the moment, so there's going to be some fantastic options for you to choose from. So if you're able to support us, that would be fantastic. So we thank you very much, and until the next time.